From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the DEQ now says over 11,000 sites in our state might be contaminated by the chemicals known as PFAS.
If you systematically go through the water supplies, not just the ones that are near known sources of contamination, but when you go methodically through them all, it's almost inevitable that you will find some that you hadn't been aware of before, and that's what's happened in Michigan.
Overhauling special ed in Detroit.
It's a common complaint. You call around, try to find a school that will take your kid, and over, folks hear, well, we don't have the resources to take care of your child.
And why it took two Tiger legends so long to get to the Hall of Fame.
But if you're Jack Morris or if you're Alan Trammell and you were very good for two decades, you have a hard time getting in.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan has declared a state of emergency in Kalamazoo County. Late last week, officials told 3,100 residents of Parchment and nearby Cooper Township to stop drinking or cooking with municipal water. That water alert came after testing showed very high levels of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, the ones known as PFAS. Today, many area residents are lining up at a water distribution site in Parchment, and they have questions, including Randy Johnson and Candy Ellert.
Well, my concern was what was in the water and how did it get there? And did they just now find it, or has it been there?
What is PFAS? What is it? How is it going to affect me? Are they really going to get rid of it by this pumping method? Or is it still going to be in there? And what are the long-term effects?
The Detroit Free Press also reports the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality now suspects PFAS water contamination might be found in more than 11,300 sites around the state. Here with us now, Dr. David Savitz, professor of epidemiology at the Brown University School of Public Health and head of the Scientific Advisory Committee for MPART, Michigan's PFAS Action Response Team. Dr. Savitz, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you very much.
So we have certainly spent a lot of time on Stateside talking about the 32 publicly reported sites, the West Michigan site around the old Wolverine Worldwide shoe and leather factory, around Oscoda, where the former Wurtsmith Air Force Base used firefighting foam for years, more recently around Selfridge Air National Guard Base in Macomb County. But this new take from the DEQ, how did we go from 32 known sites to over 11,000 possible sites in just a matter of weeks?
Well, I mean, it's in some ways unfortunate that there are so many places where historically there have been these episodes of contamination. But on the positive side, they're being these are coming up because they're being looked for. In other words, I'm sure in Michigan, as in basically any other state in the country, if you systematically go through the water supplies, not just the ones that are near known sources of contamination, but when you go methodically through them all, it's almost inevitable that you will find some that you hadn't been aware of before, and that's what's happened in Michigan.
And we know the DEQ last March issued this directive to start testing 1,300 public water supplies looking for PFAS contamination. Is this how the results in Parchment came to light, is through that testing?
That's my understanding, yes, that was not expected before. If there's a known waste site where these chemicals have been deposited and where they are thought to be likely to reach groundwater supplies for drinking water, then, of course, that would have been looked at independently. But the idea here is to look everywhere, not just in the places where there's suspicion.
When we hear this report that the DEQ is saying perhaps we could see more than 11,300 locations statewide, based on what? I guess we're all trying to understand, where did that number come from and what kinds of locations might we be talking about?
This is where I'm not sure of how they derived that. And I think the big question would be whether that includes private wells or only community supplies, because the number of private wells, once there's an area where the groundwater has been contaminated, obviously every single well in that geographic area is at risk of having elevated PFAS levels. Community supplies are different, of course. They serve larger populations, and there are fewer of them, but I don't know, you have to ask them directly where that number came from.
So remind us again just how long-lasting these chemicals are and what the potential health impacts of PFAS are.
I mean, first, it's probably worth noting that these really have only been of concern for a relatively short time, and I think as a result of that, the scientific evidence on health effects remains quite limited. However, we know that these chemicals do persist in the environment on the order of several years. Their half-life, which is the measure we use, the time it takes for half of it to disappear, is on the order of, let's say, you know, 2 or 3 years, roughly. The range of health concerns is quite wide. The work that I was part of in the Mid-Ohio Valley for the C8 Science Panel, we flagged certain health conditions where we did see a link with human health effects. And these included elevated cholesterol, disruption of thyroid hormones, selected diseases that some of which were unexpected, like ulcerative colitis. We also saw some evidence of associations with kidney cancer and testicular cancer. Again, the levels in that setting in the Mid-Ohio Valley were quite a bit higher than has been seen or is typically seen in Michigan. And the concern is not with an acute exposure, not what you're drinking today or what you've been drinking over the past few weeks or months, but rather this cumulative exposure over a period of many years.
And considering that we're talking about, for example, military bases, not just here in Michigan, but we're certainly seeing reports across the country, including that recently released Pentagon report with military sites, bases in 12 states. We're looking at possible firefighting training sites, industrial plants and dumps, civilian airports. So for so many people, this could be very long term because most of us have never heard of PFAS until recently.
Sure. No, and again, this is where part of the problem is these chemicals have such a wide array of industrial uses, including, as you mentioned, firefighting foam. And so where the military or civilian fire protection groups have been practicing and using these kinds of foams, they do over time penetrate into the aquifer, into the water supply. And if there are drinking water wells in proximity, they will be affected and they will be contaminated that way. That was something that I don't think we were aware of even maybe 5-7 years ago. We weren't conscious of, and vigilant about that particular pathway, but now we are. And not surprisingly, as we start to look for the contamination, we're finding it.
And in parchment, we're looking at a level more than 20 times higher than the EPA's lifetime health advisory of 70 parts per trillion for both chemicals, PFOS and PFOA. What should people in parchment think as they hear us talk about this?
Yeah, I think it certainly is a level where there is a concern, where the response needs to be the elimination of exposure by providing alternative sources of drinking water. It's probably worth also emphasizing that this is not known by any means to pose an acute health hazard where they're in grave danger of serious diseases, but it is nonetheless a level at which concern. I mean, the advisories are based on what we know, again, limited and incomplete, but what we know is from the scientific evidence, from laboratory studies and studies of human populations. And these are benchmarks where we at least have concerns and need to pay attention. They are not levels that are demonstrably harmful to health. That the higher it is, for the longer the time period is, the greater the risk presumably is. But to emphasize, it's not something where we know with certainty where they are going to suffer adverse health effects. But clearly, they've had an exposure and that needs to be mitigated.
Well, yeah, and I'm thinking if I'm living in parchment and I get this warning last Thursday, immediately stop drinking the water that I've been drinking for years. What do I make of that?
Yeah, no, this is one of the biggest challenges. The going forward, of course, we know what to do with it, which is to avoid the exposure. And over time, your blood levels and the health risks associated with that presumably will, whatever they are now, which is not by any means known with certainty, but the risk declines as the exposure goes away. Unfortunately, I can't give you, it's not just me, but the scientific evidence base can't say what the implications are, what the risk is, if any, what should be done about it. That's a very complicated question, other than, you know, because we don't know how long it's been there. We don't know what the levels have been like in the past, of course. And so it makes it very hard to predict with any confidence at all what the potential health risks might be. But as I said, what we do know is that it's time to have the exposure end and to be, to have alternative sources of water.
Can water filters in someone's home protect them at all from this?
So, I'm sorry, not an expert in the technology on that. There are water engineers who can better address that. There are many different approaches to removing the chemicals from drinking water, both at the level of the home and the at the community supply level. So there are technologies that can be brought to bear to address it. But again, I'm not an expert in that area.
Well, Doctor, as head of the Scientific Advisory Committee to Michigan's PFAS Action Response Team, what are you directing them? What are you telling MPART that they should be doing about, for example, this new revelation from the DEQ about more than 11,000 possible sites statewide? So what's the scientific direction they should take?
Well, I think maybe it's better to say what kinds of information we are intending to provide and where we leave off. Ultimately, there is a judgment that's going to need to be made by the state as to how to manage these kinds of situations, how to handle the issue broadly. What we're trying to do is provide the most accurate, unbiased, up-to-date scientific evidence in a form that is digestible and, you know, well, easily understood, but trying to explain what the science does and does not say at this point, with the intent, as I said, of enabling Michigan to make the right decision, taking into account its particular environment. Every, you know, community, every situation has to be handled with an awareness of all the relevant inputs, not just what we're able to offer. And so we're not going to be saying, here is what you should do. We're really saying, here is what you should know in order to determine what to do.
Dr. David Savitz is head of the Scientific Advisory Committee to MPART, Michigan's PFAS Action Response Team. He's also with Brown University. Doctor, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. Much more ahead. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it is time to check in with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon, who has been able to actually have some real summer vacation this year. We have missed you around here, John, but it is real nice to know you and the family actually have had a chance to enjoy the summer.
How about that idea?
I know. It's good to see you. So this weekend, we saw two Detroit Tiger heroes get their due with Alan Trammell and Jack Morris inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame. So what is it about each man, in your view, that made them true Hall of Famers?
Well, the hard part for them, they had to wait 20 years, basically. And they got in off the Veterans Committee, not the Baseball Writers Association. So they got in the back door, if you will. And the reason is the Hall of Fame awards excellence. If you're Sandy Koufax and you're great for 5 years, truly exceptional, you're in. But if you're Jack Morris or if you're Alan Trammell and you were very good for 2 decades, you have a hard time getting in.
Isn't that something?
Which is kind of a shame, but I'm glad they corrected that. In Trammell's case, he played in the era of the shortstop. So he's going against Cal Ripken, Robin Yount, Ozzie Smith, all Hall of Famers, and you're kind of screwed. So you get overlooked. So he got in, and he should have gotten in. The numbers are there. In Jack Morris's case, he was the best pitcher of the 80s, but you know did not beat the best out there. He's just better than everyone else over a long period of time.
Okay.
The guy's got 4 World Series, so look at that. And he's an unbelievable competitor.
Finally, they made it, and also attention being put on that 84 World Series Tigers team. I was actually at the game when they won, which
there you
was
go. Game
pretty
five,
great.
Of course,
absolutely.
Back in the day.
Absolutely. 84,
the first,
yep.
He's the first two Tigers from that championship team.
Yeah.
It's kind of amazing because that team went out to a 35-5 start, one of the best teams really around.
So who do you think should be the next Tiger to get to Cooperstown, and why?
Lou Whitaker, because his numbers are almost the same as Trammell's. It is striking. It's almost a dead heat. Those two guys were by far the longest-running double play combination, shortstop and second baseman. They turned 1,500-some double plays. That's a ridiculous amount. He should get in. However, the voters like him a lot less than they like Trammell. He was only on the ballot 1 year with the writers and did not get even 5% of the vote. So he's going to have a harder time getting there, but he's got a lot of guys pushing for him.
What's your favorite Alan Trammell story?
Easy. The last game of his career in 1996, I was a feature writer with the Detroit News writing Sunday features. So therefore, I very rarely wrote about the Tigers during that time because they stunk. So I wrote about the Red Wings a lot during that stretch. And the last game, I show up and I ask to talk to him and he says, let's go over here. And we go to a quiet area of the locker room and we talk for half an hour. He did not know me. He did not owe me anything. And he gave me everything and talked to anybody in the media. And they'll tell you the same thing, that Trammell was simply a gem. Talk to his teammates, talk to the fans, talk to the reporters. This guy's one of the best humans to play the game. So it's great to see a good guy actually finish first.
Speaking of Detroit sports heroes, Chris Chelios has left the Red Wings, gone back home to Chicago to be closer to his mom. Is there any reason for Wings fans to grumble that Chelios immediately announced he's going to be an ambassador for the Blackhawks?
No. Let it go. The guy is from Chicago. He's going home to see his mom. He's got to make a living, right? So, and he was a Blackhawk for as long as he was a Red Wing. And by the way, ambassadors don't win you playoff games. So.
That's true. And it makes me think of what it was like when Chelios swapped that Blackhawk sweater for the winged wheel, showed up on Wings ice in 1999. It was like this huge enemy, and now he's on our side.
Chelios was the best player in the Blackhawks all those years and the thorn in the Red Wings' side. He's the toughest defenseman by far. And he flips over and, like, your biggest problem is now your biggest asset. So what he did for the Red Wings was, when Vladimir Konstantinov was injured in the accident, of course, he was their toughest defenseman. Chelios fills that role and wins you two more cups with Detroit. He was essential for those teams.
And a lot of people enjoyed his chili.
I've had it. I've actually advertised it. How about that?
There you go. Things are starting to ramp up for the new college football season. You got Michigan and Notre Dame kicking things off September 1st in South Bend. And the night before, August 31st, the Spartans are going to host the Utah State Aggies. So we've heard both coaches talk about their upcoming seasons because Big Ten Media Days just happened. So what did you take away from that?
Very little. You go to this thing, by the way, everyone's had a great offseason. They've all worked hard in the weight room, and they've got great senior leadership. So you learn very little from that. However, what you do learn is what the press is thinking. Jim Harbaugh's questions were almost exclusively about his rival records against Michigan State and Ohio State. He's 1-5 against those two. So if you ask me what they have to do, clearly the focus at Michigan is on beating the Spartans and beating the Buckeyes. That's no surprise there. I think they're headed for a very good season. However, that first game against Notre Dame, circle it. I cannot recall a first game with more weight on it. If they win that game, you get on a roll. If you lose that game, you got to reassemble all over again. And they'll do it, but it's a lot harder.
And how about MSU?
MSU, the Aggies are not going to stop them. So,
what kind of questions was D'Antonio getting?
Well, he's getting questions about, of course, one of his former players who was known to issue racist comments, and they decided to bring him back based on a team vote and this and that. I don't think he handled that very well. I think D'Antonio usually does. But in this case, don't tell me what their player's vote was. And no, you're the head coach. The guy's on the team if you say he is. And don't hide behind the players. It's good to know what the players think. And I would want that as part of my data, no doubt, as the head coach. But you are the head coach. If the guy's on the team, you're responsible. And you've got to own that.
Michigan Radio Sports Commentator, John Eubacon. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Oral arguments were made today in federal court in Kalamazoo in the Bayview religious discrimination case. Bayview is the summer resort community near Petoskey. It only allows practicing Christians to buy or own property there. Dick Crossland is a longtime Bayview resident.
Our mission statement for decades has included the phrase that we're to be a community which provides a Christian perspective in a changing world.
A group calling itself the Bayview Chautauqua Inclusiveness Group has filed a lawsuit saying the historic rule violates the First Amendment, the Federal Fair Housing Act, and Michigan's Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act.
If you are married to a spouse who is not a practicing Christian and you happen to pass away, your spouse cannot inherit the property.
Sarah Prescott is their attorney.
This is not a suit that suggests that people shouldn't be allowed to practice their religion in their own way, merely that they can't discriminate in violation of state and federal law, and that they can't be the government and a practicing religion.
The Bayview community holds its annual meeting this coming Saturday, and it will consider a proposal that would make some changes in their bylaws. The judge's decision from today's hearing is not expected until after that meeting. Marquand Kane knows poverty. He's seen what gun violence, what drugs have done to people he loves. And this teenager's response is to work for social reform and challenge other young people to join him in a new civil rights movement. Marquand Kane has been named Washtenaw County's 2018 Young Citizen of the Year to recognize his work in criminal justice reform. And Governor Snyder appointed him to Michigan's Committee on Juvenile Justice, and he is with us now. Marquand, congratulations on your honor and also your recent graduation from Ann Arbor Pioneer High School.
Thank you very much.
It's been a busy few months for you. So what inspired you to begin using your voice and your energy to bring attention to issues like the school-to-prison pipeline or gun violence or domestic violence, or you're pushing to have 18-year-olds in the criminal justice system treated as juveniles rather than adults? What fired up your activism?
I got started because I was looking for purpose. During my junior year, I had lost one of my close friends, Jordan Klee, as well as my cousin in gun violence. In the same year, I had so many conflicts going on at home. You know, really, there was so much trauma going around, and it just became a generational cycle. You know, there was an incident during my junior year where, you know, outside in my neighborhood, they were shooting. And I actually had to run out there and grab a young child who was in the middle of the crossfire. You know, having to go to sleep at night listening to gunshots and, you know, with your family in that situation. You know, it hurts when it's not just you. It hurts when it's your loved ones who are caught up in the chaos of it. And so I got started because, you know, I got in this really deep, dark state of depression. You know, many of those who are close to me were struggling with suicidal thoughts, and I was battling with my own demons. And so with all the suffering that was going on, you know, plus the rise of Trump and the political chaos and everything associated with him, you know, I was wondering, can I find meaning in all of this? Can I make a difference? And I decided that I was going to.
And as far as domestic violence and the effects of poverty, you've seen that in your life and with people you love as well.
Yes, yes. You know, as a young child, you know, I have so many memories of us having to flee, you know, from my brother's father, you know, having to be in and out of safe houses, staying with friends, you know, sleeping on couches, just, you know, on the run all the time and always in a constant state of fear and vigilancy. You know, every time I'd be around this man, you know, I would start to shake and just tremble. And this is the fear that my family lived with on a daily basis, you know, for years and years and years.
So you have taken a lot of pain and you have poured it into something positive. What would you say your mission is? How do you describe it?
You know, when I got started in my advocacy, I said that I wanted to get involved to find a common humanity, you know, were my exact words. Now, I had no idea what that meant. You know, I was just saying something because I wanted to get involved. You know, but as I started to learn more history, as I started to connect with those in the community, I think it's the same goal, to achieve a common humanity, a common bond, you know, in this state of political chaos, to bring us closer together as the farther apart, you know, because in this current time, we are more polarized, I believe, than ever.
And you're saying that at 18, and I can tell you there are people many times your age who would agree with you that we are a very divided, angry and polarized country right now. And one of the things you talk about is a new civil rights movement, and you're calling on other young people to join you. So why do we need a new civil rights movement?
And so if you Google the civil rights movement, or you look at it in your textbook.
Or those of us who lived through it.
Absolutely.
But yes.
You know, it'll tell you.
You're Googling it and you're reading about it.
Yeah, you know, it'll tell you it started in the 40s and ended in the 60s. But what exactly ended? They killed their leaders, they forced them to leave the country, or they incarcerated them. But they were effectively silenced. And so we need to pick up from that wave of leadership, because not much has changed. I've, you know, seen an article from the Washington Post, and it says, you know, 50 years later, no progress for African Americans on in the areas of housing, of employment, of incarceration. You know, you look at Dr. King, and he didn't just challenge racism. He challenged, you know, poverty. He challenged the establishment. He called for a redistribution of wealth. And today we've seen even more wealth, you know, concentrated in fewer hands today. And so we need a new civil rights movement because, you know, racism and oppression have always been here. But we are currently seeing a wave of racial terrorism sweeping through our country, and it's attacking minorities of all colors, you know, different creeds, all of that.
And so what do you envision this new civil rights movement looking like here in Michigan? How do you see this working?
I see it as more society being much more conscientious. But I think that we need to consider more things civil rights. And here's my list. I think that every American and every human being ought to have access to quality and affordable food, shelter, water, housing, education, and also a guaranteed living wage, better yet, a dignity wage. And these are, I believe, our civil rights because our economy and the human body demand that we have these things in order to be productive members of society. You can't just write, you know, that every, you know, American citizen is guaranteed the blessings of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That shouldn't just be reserved to those who are privileged and the wealthiest among us.
So you are basically trying to be a catalyst for others to come join you and work in whatever ways possible to be able to bring this, the constitutional promise, to everybody. So when you think of, as you talk about being a student of history and given our current political climate, what did you learn from the civil rights movement, from what happened in the 40s and the 50s and 60s that has taught you about leadership and the role that young people can play in righting wrongs?
So I haven't traveled much and I haven't been anywhere near down south. But during our spring break trip, my friend Henry and I decided that we wanted to go down to Alabama to learn about the movement. I've talked, you know, a lot about racial justice and criminal justice reform, and I have my own experiences, you know, around those systems. But really, you know, we understood that in order to be, you know, much more effective, we'd have to go down there and actually see it, you know.
Like a pilgrimage.
Yeah, absolutely. And so we spent our time in between Selma, Birmingham, and Montgomery. And I learned, you know, and I finally was able to understand what Sean King was saying. And he was saying that it's hard to recognize a moment of history when you're living in it, but we are absolutely living in it. And I also learned that I see now that young people have to step up and guide the moral compass of this country, just as we did during the civil rights movement, because, you know, our elders have failed us, essentially. They have put us in a state of political chaos.
You have recently graduated from high school. Where do you see yourself, let's say, in 10 or 15 years? What do you see yourself doing?
You know, I hope I'll be, you know, graduated from law school. But, you know, I'm taking a gap year right now. And that's to really figure out, do I want to work within the system or work outside of it? And what's the most effective way for me to go about making change in our society? So perhaps I may be in office. Maybe I'll be practicing law somewhere. I might be a teacher, but somewhere making a difference in a subtle way.
Marquand, before you go, there was an incident where you felt targeted because of the color of your skin. Can you tell us what happened?
You know, I was in my friend's neighborhood, and I stepped outside to make a few phone calls, you know, in broad daylight.
What kind of neighborhood?
It was apartments, mm-hmm. But I was in the street. And so, you know, after a while, I was on the phone, a man approached me, a white man, and he asked me, you know, what was my business there? I said, I'm visiting a friend, but I'm on the phone right now. And, you know, I'm trying to go back and forth on the phone and have a conversation with this man at the same time. And, you know, he's asking me, you know, which apartment, you know, my friend stays in. I ask him which apartment he stays in, and, you know, he didn't reveal that for the same reason I didn't tell him where my friend stayed, right? And so, you know, he said he was maintenance, but, you know, I've worked on a few projects with maintenance, so, you know, I figured this guy was just lying. Anyways, you know, he says he's calling the cops on me. And I said, call him. You know, I'm not doing anything wrong. I'm visiting a friend. And so I went inside and, you know, sent my friend out there to go and check for me. And he says that this man is waiting out there with a knife and some rope. Now, when he approached me, he didn't have any one of those things on him. But he had him, and he got him from his truck when I had left. Now, I wasn't outside, you know, when this happened, but I want to know what he was planning on doing with that. That happened here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, because he called the police because he knew, you know, the psychological toll and effect that it would have on a young black man like myself.
Did the police come?
The police did come. And, you know, they told the man to leave, and they told me, you know, that I was not in any wrong and that I had every reason to be there. But nothing was done, and this man is still out there. And so, you know, why am I involved? I'm involved because I'm dealing with these systems of oppression on a daily basis. And I want people to wake up and realize and understand the pain that others feel. There's way too much conformity. There's way too much complicity and way too much apathy, just downright apathy of people who are not paying attention to what is happening. There's so much, you know, chaos going on the news each and every day, and I understand that. But I don't even believe that we've hit rock bottom as a nation yet. I don't think that we have. And so I'm concerned with what is coming. I believe rebellion is coming because people are fed up and people are tired of what is happening. And history shows us that those in power can only commit abuse and brutality, you know, to those who are marginalized and oppressed until they rise up and understand that they feel that they have nothing to lose. And our bodies are on assault out there every single day. There's tons of, you know, pain and trauma that people are dealing with every single day, and people are getting desperate. And so we need to come together, you know, to prevent something bad from happening.
Marquand Kane, what is your challenge to everybody listening of all ages who are hearing you talk now? What is your challenge to people?
It starts with people achieving a common humanity, at least coming to the table to have a discussion, to have a conversation. Education is the basis for all of it. This isn't about left or right. This isn't about partisan politics. Mm-hmm. This is about justice. And we need to come together for justice, economic justice, racial justice, criminal justice, environmental justice, and restorative justice.
Marquand Kane, Washtenaw County's 2018 Young Citizen of the Year. Thank you so much for sharing your work and your passion with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Coming up, we'll hear what Grand Rapids-based group Be a Rose is doing to fight period poverty and bring feminine hygiene products to those who often have to go without.
It does not isolate who experiences it based on race, gender, ethnicity, culture, even socioeconomic class, level of education. At any time in a woman's life, regardless of all those identifiers, she can experience period poverty.
That's in about 15 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan is not doing a good job educating children with disabilities. That became clear when Michigan was the only state rated as needing federal intervention because it has consistently failed to meet standards in special education. And in Detroit, the Detroit Public Schools Community District has announced a major overhaul in its special ed aimed at fixing a litany of problems. Chalkbeat Detroit's Kobe Levin has been covering this issue. We spoke with him last Tuesday, the night after Chalkbeat hosted a listening tour with Detroit parents of special needs children. I started by asking Kobe just what prompted Detroit's main district to lay out a new plan for special education.
So the district has seen dozens of state and federal complaints about its special education program in recent years. Superintendent Nikolai Vitti said that he'd never been in a district with so many complaints when he arrived just over a year ago. He actually requested an audit that would take a look at some of the weaknesses in the system, and we now have the results of that audit.
And we know, just to remind folks, that Nikolai Vitti, Dr. Vitti, has a very personal interest in educating children with special needs.
That's right. He has dyslexia himself, and he's talked about how that just is a reminder for him of the responsibilities that his district has to children who need extra help to get an education.
What did the audit find? What are some of the biggest problems with the way Detroit was handling its special education?
So for starters, students with special needs are disproportionately placed in separate classes from their non-disabled peers. Something like double the rate in Wayne County, which contains Detroit. Research has found that placing students with special needs alongside their other peers is beneficial to them and helps them learn, and it actually doesn't hurt their non-disabled peers' test scores. Another issue would be individual schools that were overloaded with special education classes. In one high school, 56% of students had special needs, and the auditors just said that makes it really difficult for principals at those schools to manage the substantial needs that these children have.
And I know the idea that in your piece in Chalkbeat, you spell out kind of ways it sounds like teachers, should we say, were gaming the system, giving children with special needs unofficial suspensions?
Right. So in focus groups with teachers, the auditors heard numerous complaints that teachers were sending children home without properly documenting that. There's a few reasons they might do that. One is just to lower the district's suspension rate overall, which is already pretty substantial. They also might be avoiding the sorts of behavioral procedures that are generally in place for students with special needs.
Something else that jumped out at me, and I'm just thinking as a parent, when a kid is in school, there was, what, one phone line for people to call in to try to communicate? That had to have been just a source of huge frustration.
Right. And this goes to the frustrations that parents just repeatedly voice when they talk about dealing with special education in the city. It is so hard to find a school that has programming that will work for your child. One reason was that it was just hard to access this placement center, which was responsible, by the way, for dealing with an entire district of roughly 50,000 people. They had a single phone line. They were understaffed. They struggled to do regular reviews of paperwork, things that just should be basic for a program like that. The district is now considering splitting up enrollment functions between schools as opposed to putting them in a single center.
And speaking of parental frustrations, Chalkbeat and the Detroit Parent Network have kicked off this listening tour. So you're asking parents of students with special needs, come share your stories?
So that's what we did last night. Our listening tour will cover more subjects. For instance, we're hoping to hold one about English language learners in September. Mm-hmm. But yes, last night it was special education parents, educators, advocates, and they were talking about their experiences caring for children with special needs.
And one of the parents there who spoke last night was Dorothea Nicholson. Let's listen to what she had to say.
The teachers, they were not knowledgeable about my daughter's situation. So accessing just the curriculum itself was a challenge. Just for my daughter to be able to read, we learned that she had a nonverbal learning disability, but no one wanted to hear that. Even having her to have access to extracurricular activities, go on field trips, we were denied a lot of that also.
So issues with appropriate curriculum, access to field trips. What other concerns did you hear about last night?
So we heard from folks who said that there aren't enough psychologists on staff to properly evaluate students, something that the district is legally required to do. We heard from parents who said that they had been shamed, actually, by district staff, including teachers, about their child's disability. Teachers who called parents into the school to say, please deal with your child, we can't handle it. Folks also had problems actually accessing schools, as I mentioned before. It's a common complaint. You call around, try to find a school that will take your kid, and over, folks hear, well, we don't have the resources to take care of your child. And you can imagine as a parent that can get pretty frustrating. One parent talked about the fight, the day-to-day battle that it is to take care of a child with special needs, not only because they require extra care on the parent's part, but because it's so difficult to access an education system that can support them.
So what you heard at this listening event very, very strongly supports the findings of the special audit, which has prompted Detroit's main district to come up with plans to overhaul its special education program. In fact, they have stopped calling it special education, haven't they?
Right. So they're now calling it exceptional student education. That's something that Dr. Beatty brought with him from Florida. It is important to note, I think, that the results of this audit aren't terribly surprising. I think the district knew that it was going to be confronting some serious problems, especially with all the state complaints that have been made against it. And, of course, districts all across the state are having similar problems. This is not a city issue, not only a city issue. It's not just a Detroit issue. One advocate at the event last night just started listing off suburban districts, Ann Arbor, Grosse Pointe, where similar problems exist in special education.
So a lot can be learned from this reform plan that's been announced. So apart from the name change, what are some of the most important reforms?
So a key one that Dr. Beatty has talked about is building trust with parents. That will mean a hotline for complaints. They've talked about holding a biannual focus group, conducting an annual survey that would just get parent feedback. You do often hear from parents who say, you know, I've emailed district officials and I'm not getting a satisfactory response. And I think that this is a bid by the district to bring parents into the circle a little bit. They've also talked about increasing the number of students with special needs who are attending class alongside their non-disabled peers. You know, essentially every point that's brought up in the audit, from the unofficial suspensions that we mentioned to, for instance, the disproportionate enrollment rate. Detroit has many more students with special needs than surrounding districts. It's all in the plan. Dr. Beatty and his team didn't disagree with one point in the audit's recommendations, and I think that they've tried to fold virtually all of those recommendations into their plan. So it remains to be seen how that will go.
I think one thing that jumps out in the writing you've done in Chalkbeat Detroit, Kobe Levin, is the issue of teacher shortages. It's something that the district in Detroit is struggling with overall, but especially acute in special education. Why so hard to fill those positions?
Well, the state has actually recognized that it's much more difficult to be a special education than to be just about any other kind of teacher. So the sort of fast track programs that they have in place for a lot of teacher certification programs don't exist in special education. They're actually forbidden. You have to go through traditional avenues to become certified as a special education teacher. That, and I think frankly, the difficulty of the job is one of the reasons the districts, not just Detroit, but all districts all across the state, have a lot of trouble finding special education teachers.
And it sounds like a lot of these reforms are going to depend on having bodies in those teaching positions.
That's right. And not just bodies, but teachers who are trained. Another yes. aspect of the plan within the district will be boosting professional development, making sure that teachers are aware of how to identify a student with special needs, for instance.
Yeah, so we should say trained bodies. In fact, the audit found that generally it was the parents calling attention to an issue that it wasn't being found in school early when maybe some real difference could be made for intervention.
Yeah, so this actually comes from data that paints a pretty stark picture. Basically, every grade level in the district has an increasing number of students with special needs from kindergarten to eighth grade. So the number increases, and that suggested to the auditors that the district just isn't identifying students early enough. So students wind up in special education because they experience academic failure or because their problems have grown out of control and are impossible to ignore, as opposed to identifying disabilities early on through the warning signs that special education teachers are trained to recognize.
Kobe, finally, where's the money for these fixes? Where is that going to come from?
So it's a complicated question because the solutions are going to fall in sort of different baskets for the district. We've talked about a teacher shortage. The district has a hiring plan that will, of course, think about hiring special education teachers as well. The curriculum issue falls into yet another corner of the district, you know, and the district is already undertaking a major curriculum overhaul. And then there are some fixes that I think may not fit into the budget at all. For instance, schools have talked about needing to centralize enrollment, or rather decentralize enrollment, to make enrollment happen at the level of the school. And that would just mean sort of shifting the organization of the district around. It could even mean, you know, reducing the cost of special education by cutting the cost of that placement center that we mentioned before.
Well, some challenges and solutions, and as you say, Kobe Levin, this is not just a Detroit problem, so it's something that districts across the state could watch and learn from. Kobe Levin with Chalkbeat Detroit, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
There's no denying this. People everywhere need access to feminine pads, tampons, and other feminine hygiene products. But all throughout Michigan, some women and people in the transgender community have to go without. It's a global phenomenon my next guest calls period poverty. Christine Wangi is founder of Be a Rose. It's an organization that's working to fight period poverty in the Grand Rapids area. Christine is with us now. Christine, start by telling us, what exactly is period poverty?
Period poverty is a time in someone's life when they either have no access to feminine hygiene products or cannot afford them. Therefore, there's a barrier to access because of poverty. As a result, most people end up just making do with non-conventional products. So they may be using paper towel, toilet paper, socks, pieces of cloth, because as we know, life doesn't stop because your period came. In fact, in your most stressed days, you experience great hormonal changes in your body, which then inform how your period is going to come or not come. So it actually, for some people, ends up being heavier or more painful or longer if they're stressed.
So explain the work that you're doing in West Michigan under this umbrella of Be a Rose.
Our mission addresses the access to women's health education and the access to feminine hygiene products. We realized that a lot of women could make more informed decisions about their health if they knew what the female reproductive system is, how it functions, in order to identify times in their life when their health has not been off peak performance, let's say. Younger girls are more so making uninformed decisions, especially when it comes to sexual relations, because they don't think that when you have your period, you can actually get pregnant. Mm-hmm. We are seeing statistically that girls are getting their periods younger and younger and younger. And sometimes mothers are not equipped to tell their daughters about their period. So we are seeing impacts that are results of ill information and the decisions that result from that being detrimental to women's health and their success in the community. And so then the second part of what our mission addresses is the access to feminine hygiene products. So historically and currently, feminine hygiene products are not subsidized or covered by government subsidies such as food stamps or Medicaid. So women who may be in financial constraints that the government even defines to be financial constraints because they're eligible for food stamps and Medicaid, they still do not cover those products. So even if you're on welfare, you're still lacking the products that you need to manage menstruation. And it's not just pads and tampons. Women, when having their period, also need toilet paper. They need soap. They need toiletries on top of the products like pads and tampons to absorb the blood during menstruation. And none of these products are covered by food stamps.
So you're there to give them access to these very important feminine hygiene products. And you work with other organizations to help make this happen, don't you?
Absolutely. We decided to partner with organizations in Grand Rapids who are already established and have in place the screening tools to determine who's at greater need. Through those partnerships, we then are able to distribute feminine hygiene products to the most marginalized women in our community.
And where do you get the products from? Are you getting donations? Are you fundraising?
We fundraise through parties with a purpose. Those are small local parties that people host and collect donations through drives, and they pool them together and they're able to present them to our organization. Another way we do so is we have an Amazon wish list, which on our website, supporters can click on and go onto Amazon and use their Amazon accounts to donate that way. We have some people who also go and shop for products themselves and are able to drop them off at local drop-off points in businesses that have opened their doors to collect donations for us during their business hours.
And I know Be a Rose. Rose stands for Recreating Our Self-Esteem. How do you see your work impacting these women and girls when you get them in touch with the napkins and the tampons and pads that they need and other products? How do you see that change them?
It changes them greatly, because until they experience our work, a lot of them have told us, I have never gone to a place that I knew specifically addressed feminine hygiene. I've never gone to a food pantry where I was guaranteed I could find feminine hygiene products. And I personally don't know of anywhere in Grand Rapids where I'm guaranteed to have access to these products free of charge. In addition, some women have also made comments like, I've never had an opportunity to talk to other women about our health as women. I've not been in a setup where I could feel safe to discuss reproductive illnesses or to discuss different illnesses that surround menstruation. So other than these women's primary doctor, which most of them don't even have a relationship with primary care doctors because some of them are homeless, some of them are in transition, and so the only places they access the healthcare system is the emergency room. They don't even have access to our medical professionals who are in the community equipped to address these matters.
Do you see yourself expanding this work to other cities, other states even?
Absolutely. We capture the zip code of all the women who access either our product or our workshops. And majority of the time, women are coming from outside of the Grand Rapids city lines to access our partners inside of the city of Grand Rapids in order to therefore have access to us. So it's really telling that women really go far outside of their local regions to the bigger cities around them to access resources such as those that our partners offer. So it's imperative that in the future we expand our work to even reduce the barrier, for example, transportation barrier that women have who are in transition trying to access services.
Changing women's lives and changing the lives of girls. And the work you're doing is in Grand Rapids, but as you say, there is a need really everywhere you look. And we have put a link to Be a Rose on the stateside page at michiganradio.org, or you just go to bearose.org and find out about the work done by my guest, Christine Wongi. Christine, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Lindsay Scullin. Our engineer was Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Today's contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, and April Van Buren. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.